Hi everyone, nice to see you. Now we changed computers and I'm told this might mean that the sound doesn't work straight away, so try to be patient with me. I'm going to talk about smuttishness, which was a sort of theme that came out from the keynote talk yesterday, and particularly about squeamishness at Jewish identity within America. And I'm going to deal with a musical that no one's ever heard of, but you never know, you might like it. So here we go. The 1946 Broadway musical Loose Song is most often remembered today as the first show to feature the Russian-born actor Yul Brynner, who went on to star in The King and I, and for presenting Nancy Davis, who would go on to become the wife of President Ronald Reagan. However, Loose Song offers a particularly interesting reflection on its Jewish-American composer, Raymond Scott, who has become something of a cult figure since the 1990s. When CD reissues of his music brought a new audience to the quirky pseudo-minimalist style of his novelty jazz and electronic music. Scott, who was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1908, trained in electronic engineering at Brooklyn Technical High School and in music at what is now the Juilliard School. He enjoyed considerable fame in the late 1930s when he led his six-man quintet in numerous broadcasts and recordings. In 1939, he expanded his quintet into a highly successful big band, and then in 1942, he became the director for various shows on CBS Radio. He left CBS in 1944 to pursue other interests, including Loose Song, but found public recognition again in 1949, when he replaced his brother as the band leader on the popular radio show Your Hit Parade. The radio show paid well, and its move from radio to television in 1950 made Scott something of a household name. However, he considered his public role just as a means to fund his private creative enterprise that by then included development of electronic instruments and music. As a composer band leader, Scott was not an easy man to work with. His bandsmen had to submit to his will and his unorthodox and often bullying working methods. These favoured working out music by ear and by rote, rather than using musical notation. In this sense, Scott composed on his band, rather than with them or on paper. And the attraction of electronic composition for him was that it ultimately removed the mediation of other musicians from his compositional process altogether. The increasingly private and personal nature of Scott's creativity meant that he became a recluse during the 1960s. He was enterprising enough, though, to make his creativity pay by producing electronic music for television adverts and by attracting the support of Motown's Berry Gordy. However, when the television work and royalties dried up, he began to fade into obscurity. And by the late 1980s, when a series of strokes curtailed his creativity, he was largely a forgotten figure. Loose Song, though, comes from the heyday of Scott's career. The show was an adaptation of a 14th century Chinese play called Pi Pa Ki. Its script resulted from collaboration between playwright Sidney Howard, author of the screenplay for Gone with the Wind, and the journalist and Chinese theatre enthusiast Will Irwin. It was staged as a straight play first at the Catholic University of America in 1944, where the risk-taking Broadway producer Michael Meyerberg saw it and decided to transform it into a musical vehicle for Mary Martin, an actress then at the height of her fame. Lyrics by Bernard Hannigan and music by Raymond Scott were added in 1945, and the director John Houseman was employed to stage the show. After some changes in the production team, it was tried out in regional theatre in Philadelphia and elsewhere, before it opened on Broadway on the 6th of February 1946. The critics praised the show's attempt to update a Chinese original, whilst otherwise critiquing it as a form of musical theatre. Thus, Lewis Nichols surmised in the New York Times that, and I quote, "its intentions are more worthy than their fulfillment is complete." Nevertheless, the show attracted a core of admirers, even among the critics, and it ran for 142 performances before touring the United States. It subsequently travelled to London, where it lasted for 68 performances at the Winter Gardens Theatre. It enjoyed a brief revival in 1959 at New York City Centre Theatre, but then faded into obscurity. In the original production, Mary Martin took the role of the ever-faithful wife, Chao On Yang, who stands by her husband, Cy Yong, played by Brynner. when he leaves his village for the capital to secure the family's future by entering imperial service as a magistrate. She promises to be faithful and to look after his aging parents until the couple are reunited. In the city, Brynner's character is forced by an imperial decree into a second marriage to a princess. Meanwhile, famine besets his village, and his trusty first wife is reduced to selling her hair to pay for the burial of her in-laws, who, despite her best efforts, perish from hunger. In shame and fearing her husband is dead, she becomes a pious nun who is prone to visions. The story ends happily, though, when the gods reward the faithful wife's constancy by leading her to find her husband in the city. He faces a choice between love and filial piety, but the princess, on meeting the wife, sees the unhappiness of the couple's situation and relinquishes marital rights so all can end happily. Lute's Song was unorthodox as a Broadway show, both for its Chinese source material and its mode of presentation. This represented authentic Chinese theatre for a Broadway audience for the first time. The song Mountain High, Valley Low exemplifies its musical orientalism. It comes from towards the beginning of the show and expresses the wife's vow of steadfastness in the face of her husband's departure. Mary Martin recorded the song in 1947, with Scott conducting the Broadway show band. As you'll hear, it's full of Scott devices and musical orientalism, from the evocative Celesta or Glockenspiel in the introduction to the pentatonic melody shadowed in thirds by low register flute and accompanying parallel harmonies. Importantly, although this music was rooted in Scott's research of Chinese music, there is also a good deal of lyrical Broadway in the song. Switzerland, to name just three. These novelty pieces have ethnic cultural dissonance built into their musical materials because they are most often in a ternary form, in which the contrasting B section represents an unexpected encounter with the other culture. This encounter leaves its mark because when the A section recapitulates, it is marked by devices drawn from the exotic B section. This exoticism of Scott's quintet aesthetic is most apparent in the band's appearance in the 1937 movie Ali Baba Goes to Town, which starred Eddie Cantor and spoofed Roosevelt's New Deal politics in a form of an extended dream sequence set in Baghdad. In a diversionary episode, Scott's band in silly costumes mimes to their hit Twilight in Turkey as they accompany two veiled dancers. The drum solo introduces the A section of the piece, and then listen out for it again because it introduces the B section a few seconds later. In this, pseudo-exotic finger cymbals and shakers accompany cliché mock Arabic melodies in E-flat minor on the muted trumpet. This melody then shifts to E minor for the clarinet solo, and then an agile, trill-laden alto saxophone solo in F minor leads to the return of the C major A section. However, before long, the finger cymbals make a comeback to interrupt the recapitulation with material from the B section, as in, for instance, the trills that you'll hear at the close of the track.
Right, and this is a YouTube thing, so we'll see if we can get this to work. Here we go, we're all set.
Neurosis over his Jewish American identity. Raymond Scott was really named Harry Warner, or Varnoff, until he selected a new name from the Manhattan telephone directory in the early 1930s. This pseudonym avoided confusion with his brother, Mark Warner, a famous 30s band leader in his own right, and it hid his Russian Jewish parentage. Scott was typical of pre-war Jewish Americans, worrying that his Jewishness positioned him on the wrong side of the apparent black-white racial divide in American society. As Eric Goldstein makes clear, it was only after the war that Jews were considered a part of white mainstream, as before it, they occupied a problematic position as neither black nor white enough to fit within that mainstream of American identity. Scott's anxiety in appearing Jewish, and thus not fitting in with American mainstream, reached such a point that he underwent a rhinoplasty nose job procedure in the later 1930s to change the shape of his nose. Scott's nose job indicates that he found problematic Jewishness rooted in his body, and it was not just his nose that bothered him. He avoided all talk of sex and could not bring himself to name his six-man band the Sextet for fear it would take people's mind off his music. Scott's awkwardness about sex in relation to his sense of troublesome Jewish subjectivity is, of course, highly Freudian, and the psychoanalytic line of thought illuminates Scott's case a little further. The French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan theorized subjectivity as inherently divided, always already in a process, and fundamentally incoherent, which is why he represents it as slashed across the S image there. However, he argued that this reality is at odds with the imagined wholeness of the subject, that develops during the mirror stage of infancy. In other words, we imagine a whole and coherent self-image when actually this is an illusion. And in fact, we are constantly reminded of the inconsistency of the self in daily life. The realization that the real self may be fundamentally incoherent is very distressing, and it's thus the cause of much neurosis and even psychosis in extreme cases. Therefore, we seek to cover over any apparent inconsistency by forming a symbolic relationship with what Lacan called objet petit a, where a stands for autre, or other. In Lacanian thought, the function of fantasy is thus to stage for the subject the inconsistency of identity relative to the desired but inaccessible other object. And that's what that's meant to represent. What this Lacanianism suggests is that Scott's musical fantasies tend to frame his divided subjectivity as a Jewish American relative to some irreconcilable other ethnicity, whether that be the Arabian, the Oriental, or the Swiss. In the pieces for his quintet, these fantasies represent a juxtaposed or dissonant form within the ternary structure of the music, as we heard. But in Lutzon, that cultural dissonance is not such a contrast, but Orientalism is rather more constant and integrated into the musical language of the show. In fact, it has an important narrative function in this regard. Mountain High, Valley Low establishes the wife's fidelity to her husband in the face of his departure to the capital, as we heard. But its pentatonic Oriental theme becomes a musical representation of her constancy, and it represents at various points in the wife's journey towards reconciliation with her husband. For example, the theme, set in the same key but sped up somewhat, becomes the melody for another song, See the Monkey. This is sung in the course of the wife's journey to the capital, when she encounters some children, and thereby establishes her mothering or motherly qualities relative to the show's central trajectory of desire. Have a little listen to that.
Monkey see and monkey do, he like to be a person.
So it's the same thing.
If you make him mad, and you are alive to find him back.
Mountain High, Valley Low is also reprised just before the couple are reunited in the show's happy ending, and thus wife's constancy is played out in a musical way in the score. There is thus a sense in which Orientalism is as much a constant in the show as the wife's enduring love for her husband. However, one of the most heart-wrenching sequences in Lutzon, and it's treated musically incredibly sensitively, is the scene in which Martin's character is forced to cut off her hair and sell it to buy food for her ailing parents-in-law. There is, of course, a parallel between this bodily act of cutting and Scott's actions in the face of his Jewish appearance. This perhaps explains why this moment marks such an emotional high point in the show that is encapsulated in a minor key AABA ballad, Bitter Harvest. However, this song with harp-like piano arpeggios and sweeping strings in the background is much more the stuff of Broadway than the Orient, as we might hear.
And though it's harvest time, my care is in its prime. We'll buy my bitter harvest rich and rye. The shear will have its way, a tear has had its day. We'll buy my bitter harvest rich and rye.
The Mars Sound Archive at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, where Bill hangs out, there are some interviews that Scott held with a Mr. Zhu, who demonstrated various instruments and scales used in Chinese music. Thus, Scott intended Lutzon to be rooted in Chinese authenticity in a way that his cliched camp exoticism of his quintet music was not. However, it is telling that for such emotional high points in the show, such as Bitter Harvest, Scott abandons the Oriental style that he researched and resorts to a more stereotypical Broadway music. In other words, when the music serves as description or as comedy, Scott deploys Orientalism. But when things get serious for the characters, he resorts to the mainstream style of Broadway. It seems, then, that Lutzon represents both a change in Scott's approach to musical Orientalism and his representation of his Jewish American identity. Given that Goldstein has shown that Jews were considered part of the white mainstream of American society by the time Lutzon was written in 1946, it seems reasonable to suggest, following Lacan, that Scott was able to traverse the sort of fantasy scenario that is typically represented in his quintet style. For Lacan, traversing the fantasy involves learning to accept that the other object of fantasy, the Oriental in this case, is usually a vital support, and it's actually vital to our sense of individual subjectivity. This involves subjectifying both the trauma of the inherently divided subject and the pleasure engendered by engaging in it relative to that other. The triumph of a wife's Oriental musical constancy in Loose Song can be seen and understood to stand in for the unashamed Jewish constancy in Scott's resubjectivized identity as a Jewish American. This exotic Jewishness is no longer a problematic and dissonant intrusion, as it was in Scott's 1930s music, but something harmoniously integrated within the very fabric of this piece of Broadway theatre. Furthermore, Scott shows great confidence in his newly rationalized mainstream identity, in abandoning exoticism to express the emotional high points of the narrative in the mainstream language of Broadway. Ultimately, this shows there is much truth in Edward Said's observation that Orientalism is less about the East and more about defining Occidental identity relative to the Orient. In that sense, it is exploitative, but at the level of the individual subject, there is much to be gained in evoking the Orient in this way. Furthermore, when read in Lacanian terms, as I have done, lots of enjoyment or jouissance is offered in such Orientalism. And perhaps if the critics had read Loose Song in such terms, it might be better known today as a fascinating commentary on its equally fascinating Jewish-American composer and his engagement in Oriental fantasy. Thank you.